Good evening, everybody. Nice to be back after a lot of travels this summer. So the name of my Dharma talk tonight is Michael Stone and the Dharma of Sudden Endings. So some of you may have read in the Buddhist publications or on social media or elsewhere that a very prominent Buddhist teacher died recently of a drug overdose. And it made headlines near and far. It was even in the Washington Post. He was very well known throughout the world. And I wanted to talk about this tonight from the standpoint of Dharma, how we view teachers and how we view practice. And I needed some time to digest this before speaking or writing about it. There have been so many ideas and opinions about this, so much to unpack and examine about his life and his death, and about awakening and practice. And I wanted to start by saying that one of the reasons I had maybe a personal response to this that went beyond the more generalized response of this happening to a well-known Dharma teacher is that when I was at Spirit Rock in May, after I taught my class, during the evening, the teachers get together in a teacher's lounge and have dinner together. And so we come from our different places of teaching. And so I went into the teacher's lounge, and there was only one person in there. And he said, well, the rest of the group that were teaching, they were in a panel, actually. It was on psychedelics and the Buddhist path. So he was one of the people that had been on that panel, and he said, everybody else is down there talking. I said, you want to just go ahead and have dinner? And I said, sure. And so he and I had dinner together, and we had very intimate discussion about teaching, about livelihood for Dharma teachers, about Sangha. So we had a really lovely discussion. And at the end of the discussion, he took some time to thank me for the conversation, and he said that he rarely had such intimate discussions about teaching and livelihood. And he said, I really appreciate this. It doesn't happen very often, and this means a lot to me to have this discussion, this conversation. And so the next morning, as I was leaving and I was waiting for my shuttle to pick me up, he was heading out. He was going out for a hike, and he saw me standing there, and he stopped, and he asked me if I needed a ride somewhere, if I needed help in some way, and I thanked him. I was okay, but it was just a kind, thoughtful act. And so that was the last time that I saw him. So it was only that one brief encounter. And when I saw the announcements about this Dharma teacher who had died, initially I didn't even make the connection. I didn't know it was him. And it was only after I started to read more about him and his story and go onto his website that I realized that it was the same person. It was hard for me to imagine. So the person that had been described as the one who died and the one I met, it just didn't seem like it could have been the same person. And the reason was because what I discovered was that Michael had a bipolar disorder, and he was going through an extremely difficult phase right before he died. And he had gotten treatment, and he was getting treatment, but it was not working. The treatment wasn't working for him, and he was suffering a lot. He was in a lot of pain, and he was seeking some relief from his pain, and he sought some help with medication, and he wound up having a drug overdose. He died from the drug overdose, and it was totally unexpected. And so it was very shocking, and it was shocking to a lot of people, his students and others, who didn't know he had a mental health challenge. And what his wife said in sharing about his death was that there had been such a stigma around this that they didn't know how to talk about it. And he was at a point where he wanted to talk to his community and his students and tell them what was going on, but he never got the chance. And there was a lot of writing and discussion, you know, about how this is kind of kept secret. Certain mental illnesses, there's really a stigma around it, and it's not often discussed, and it's difficult for people, especially a revered Buddhist teacher who on one level seemed to have it all going for him, but yet this other side where he was really suffering and struggling. And that sometimes can create a real dissonance, like how can this fit together? How can this be the same person? And I think one of the things I have talked about, and many of us have talked about, is that meditation is a wonderful thing. In yoga, he was also a very accomplished yoga practitioner. Meditation and yoga are wonderful, and they can do a lot for people. And it certainly has, meditation has done a great deal for me and has helped me in many ways. But there are certain things that meditation doesn't address. Certain things like bipolar disorder. You know, you have to have that treated in a different way. And with bipolar disorder, it actually has a higher suicide rate than even schizophrenia. It's like 15% plus. It's a very difficult diagnosis for people. And so he was struggling with this and suffering with this. And I think when we see something like this, it's really easy to struggle with trying to find an answer, an explanation, a why. Sometimes we really have to hold these questions in don't know mind. You know, how can one person have both qualities, and to really reflect something so clearly in his teaching, but to also have this other side? And so there's a question, how do we hold that in a kind of not knowing, where we can open our heart to it without automatically trying to figure it out mentally or psychologically to come up with an easy explanation, but to be willing to look at how deep suffering can manifest for some people. And so for him, this was a really profound, deep suffering that had returned. He had had it in his early life. It had kind of stabilized, but it had come back. And so this suffering was manifesting. And not everything, as I said, can be cured through practice, even though he was really passionate about the Dharma. It meant a great deal to him. And yet some things can't be cured in that way. So I wanted to read something an article I read. A friend of Michael's had written this, and I really thought he came to something really important in this article about really looking at how somebody could be both manifesting something really beautiful about the Dharma and yet still have these deep troubles. And it's an article called Putting to Rest the Myth of the Heroic Self. And it was written by a friend of his, Michael's, named Matthew Gindin. I just want to read this quote. Michael Stone, from a Buddhist perspective, was a flow of conditions, a dance of factors and facts that he didn't choose or control. There was no essential Michael who could have resisted the impulses or heroically chosen differently. Dogen taught in the Genjo Koan that just as the reflection of the moon does not break the drop of water it is reflected in, enlightenment does not erase the personality of the practitioner. Michael, like all of us, contained not only the whole moon of Buddha nature, but also the whole rain-filled sky. He was a manifestation of the universe, an expression of all that he met, including a world of contradictions, a world of beauty, as well as suffering. And one of the things his wife said is much of his success traces back to his mind. She called it rapid fire and wide open. And she said, I think his neurological wiring made him a certain kind of genius and also vulnerable, a coin that has two sides, light and shadow. And so these contradictions, sometimes we have to hold them in a kind of skillful means. And the skillful means is that we let go of the clinging to an opinion or an idea. And sometimes that brings up doubt. Like, well, how could this happen? And I can speak to that personally. In my early years, I practiced with a Zen teacher who was quite charismatic and quite brilliant. And for a number of years, I really thought that he had, you know, he had the Dharma way. He really had it down. And then after almost 10 years, I discovered a shadow side. And the shadow side was that he was an alcoholic, and he was had issues with sexual misconduct, as some teachers do. And I think one of the problems with him was that he was held up on a pedestal like a guru, and nobody saw the other side of him. I didn't see it, and nobody else saw it. And when I did see it, it threw me into a great deal of doubt and concern, like who is this person that I thought I knew? there was this shadow side that had been hidden. And it took me a while to really recover from that and to say, well, he'd been practicing all these years, but he still had this dark side. But in this case, it wasn't being brought out in the open. He wasn't acknowledging this other side. And when it came out into the open, there was only denial, which is very different from Michael Stone's mental illness, his situation that he was dealing with at a level that he didn't have choice. So this was a different situation where, of course, alcoholism and addiction can be a struggle and not a choice, but when it's being held in secrecy and a different image is being put out and that person isn't getting treatment, that can be very damaging to the students around them. So in that case, my teacher, that was a really difficult situation, and he had to pull away from his sangha. And I want to read this from Joseph Goldstein. We often mistakenly assume that because someone has genuine understanding in one particular area, this mastery necessarily extends to all other areas of life. That may or may not be true. So he qualified that. That may or may not be true. And I think it's important personally, because of the lesson I learned with my teacher, we have to be careful to not put a flag in our version, a particular version of awakening. So what do we think is awakening, and do we only hold on to that? And so in Michael Stone's passing, you know, on Facebook, there were a lot of opinions and ideas in the comments section, of course, and most were limited to one perspective, and it didn't really include a depth of understanding, a willingness to kind of touch into the suffering of the heart, of the loss of somebody, and also his loss, because that takes time. And you know how social media is, it's kind of rapid fire. A lot of things are said, commented on, before there's a chance to really digest or to really know what's inside of somebody's heart. And so it comes back to that challenge of holding this in a place of not necessarily knowing the answer right away, but creating space for unanswered questions, and letting go of this myth of the heroic self, the one who finally gets it right, and in getting it right is finally okay. And I think a lot of us can struggle this core human condition of feeling at some deep place in ourselves, there's something about us that isn't quite right. We're not quite okay, and there is something that's gonna fix it. It's like the idea, I'm not quite okay as I am, so something is going to fix it, whether it's something outside, whether it's something inside, but there's going to be this point where I finally get it right, and then I'm going to be okay. And of course, that's an illusion. And this fantasy, you know, ultimately, I think we see that it doesn't really work, no matter what validation or success comes, whatever we do in our lives, that there's still this part, this feeling, it's not quite enough. There's something else that I need to make me okay. There's something else. And this is really the suffering of the individual or separate self. You know, as Buddha taught, our deepest suffering is the self that feels separate, that feels somehow something isn't quite right with me, and there's something I'm gonna do that's gonna make it right, and then I'm gonna be whole. And so this is a lot of our practice, is coming to the point of understanding that we are not going to get it right, but that there is a way in the kind of paradox of letting go and of not trying to get it right, but finding a fulfillment just in being with things as they are in this moment, that there becomes a way in which it's okay, that we feel okay. So I want to read again from Matthew Gindin. Threaded through the tangle of misery are strings of light. We are no more responsible for the light than for the dark, but surely it is wise to celebrate the beauty of the light that is manifested in and through us. Let's remember and celebrate that in Michael and in ourselves, and let's put to rest the myth of the heroic self, the one who finally gets it all right. Let's get ourselves off the hook, and then see what small bodhisattva activity we can get up to today in our crazy and imperfect life, where death is behind an unknown door. So again, you know, really looking at this as practice isn't about getting it right, which is really just an idea that's coming from our thinking mind, you know, the realm of ideas. It's not coming from experience or wisdom of the heart. And so if we can see that dissonance and we begin to open and we begin to see things as they are, we can discover something really beautiful in this practice. And when we see it doesn't conform to our ideas or our thoughts, the real practice really is beyond that. In the realm of the absolute, it will not conform to our ideas. And practice takes us to the heart of our experience and out of our ideas. It breaks that illusion down. And so even I noticed on Facebook, Michael had quoted Sylvia Borstein. And the quote that he had on his page was, "Mindfulness meditation doesn't change life. Life remains as fragile and unpredictable as ever." But she also said, "Meditation changes the heart's capacity to accept life as it is. It teaches the heart to be more accommodating, not by beating it into submission, but by making it clear that accommodation is a gratifying choice." And so I think in the challenge of looking at teachers or people who've practiced a long time, we have to remember that everyone is still human, and meditation doesn't take away our humanity. But perhaps it helps us to become more at peace with our humanity, and through that, perhaps our heart can open in a way that we find more kindness and compassion for ourselves and others. And along those lines, I think there was a quote from Noah Levine that always stuck in my mind. I don't have the exact quote with me, but I can sort of sum up what he had to say. He said, "A lot of Buddhist teachers want you to believe that they are living this enlightened life all of the time, but they're really not. Behind closed doors, they're not that different from you and me. Most of them still get angry when someone cuts them off in traffic." So, you know, maybe I would say from my experience, maybe from practice, you know, we don't get angry as long, we don't hold on to it as long, but it doesn't mean that there aren't those moments. And, you know, for me, my attempt as a teacher has always been to be vulnerable, to be real, to be human, and not to create a guru image. If somebody's looking for a guru, they probably aren't looking for me, because I really want to reveal who I am. I want to show my human side, the fact that I'm not perfect. But at the same time, I want to show how much I've gotten out of this practice over the years, how much it's done for me. And my dharma, my motivation in teaching is really to share this and to share the beauty and everything that I have really gotten out of this practice that has been so wonderful, even though I'm still human. And even though I still struggle, I make mistakes, I sometimes get angry, you know, I'm not perfect. But I try with my teaching to share what I deal with and how I deal with it and how the practice has helped me, so that hopefully a relatively full picture is being offered. Because that way, it's both the shadow and the light, you know? Buddha nature, human nature, and delusion and enlightenment, as Dogen says. One of my favorite teachings of his, delusion and enlightenment are not separate. They come together. And so this human nature and this Buddha nature are right here. This is part of being human and part of having a practice, so that we can really see both sides of the coin, and to live it. So I will open it up for any questions or comments.
Definitely a bit of hero worship. And even if we know, we think we know better, we still tend to kind of put our teachers up on a pedestal with that. And you had mentioned something about how we think of enlightenment, like what do we think of it? And for me, it's only as good as how you encounter each moment. Like it's one thing for me to meditate or identify a certain way or come here on Monday nights and do a reading. But the proof for me is in each moment and experience off the cushion where I'm encountering something or a person or an event and how I respond to that. And then sometimes I look back and think, well, I could have made a different choice there. And I still think, well, a lot of the times I could have made a better choice. So it's not that we have it all figured out, but because of the Dharma, because of the meditation and the teachings, I feel like each time I get a little closer to how I'd like it to be. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of unattainable perfection.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just never.
Yeah, well said. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it really is. And it's really fluid in the sense that as soon as we think we get it, then it slips away from our hands. And then it's like you said, it's really the freshness of meeting the moment, you know, and coming back again and again. And it's the idea. It's the idea that we've gotten it right, that we've really gotten it now, that in fact is the impediment that has to keep being released again and again to touch this moment with an open heart.
Also, a quick question, I haven't read everything about Michael Stone, I've read a little bit, but is it the feeling that the overdose was intentional or accidental?
The feeling was it was accidental. The feeling was it was an overwhelming kind of struggle and that it was not a suicide, or in this case it was not, no. The feeling was that it definitely was unintentional.
But that happens so much with prescription drugs. People think, you know, it's only illicit or street drugs or something. But even with drugs that you get from your doctor, they could still be misused or overused.
Mm-hmm.
So. I've been finding value kind of in the same kind of approach that you're talking about now, where instead of trying to look at enlightenment or awakening is this kind of like big reveal that might happen someday, that just looking at the moment and, you know, seeing that there are times that, you know, where there's a witness and valuing that for what it is. And then you have the choice of the very next moment. So every moment's kind of that choice of, am I going to, you know, really pay attention and let the witness occur or not? And I think it's just that simple.
It's what?
Maybe it's just that simple. You know, we don't have to elaborate much more than that.
Now, I think, though, one of the aspects is that sometimes the conditioned patterns are so strong that there's not a choice, and that we can only cultivate the intention. That's where intention comes in. You know, we cultivate where those conditioned patterns are so strong that we really can't meet the moment yet. So there's an intention, and through that intention, it sort of opens up. So I think that's where, you know, some people will ask me about that. I just, sometimes our patterns overwhelm our ability to be present, and then it's intention, compassion, patience, you know, and constancy, and so then it opens, you know. Then there's more capacity, I think, to meet the moment. We develop more capacity, but it just takes sort of the willingness to ultimately over and over again to bring our attention to this, and if we can't, then to see what's preventing us from doing that and keep working at it.
Thank you.
are no other comments, I do have some other news to share with you all. And that is that our retreat place that we had, where we do our retreats, is not going to be available. We just found out very, very late into the game that Bethany Hills is not going to be available in December, where we usually do our retreats, and that they discovered bed bugs. And they have not been able to get rid of them yet. And so they've shut the entire facility down. And so we will not be doing a retreat at Bethany Hills. For those of you who want to do the retreat, we did find an alternate location, which is Peniel Ridge, which is a nice place. And we are going to be able to do it there. It's a smaller place. It only can hold about 16 students and me. And so, and there won't be any private rooms. Everybody will have to share with others. And I just wanted to context for anybody who is used to your own room that it's rare to, in most meditation retreats, to actually have your own room. And so Bethany Hills, we've been really spoiled with that. Normally you do share rooms, you know, and that's part of the practice, part of what you do. And Frankie said, oh, you should tell everybody. I've told Frankie about this. You should tell everybody about, you know, that you've slept on living room floors and that you've, you know, I've put together zabutons and slept on them in meditation halls. I've probably slept in just about every condition imaginable. I've slept in dorms with tons of people. And I've probably experienced every configuration of sleeping situations that you can imagine, cots, you know, in living rooms with other, you know, just every configuration. And so this is still a pretty comfortable place. It's better than a lot of the things I've done. But just to let you know that it will not be a private rooms for those who want to do the retreat. We will have to make some adjustments for this retreat. It's actually a nicer space. So the beds are nicer, the space is, so it's nicer, but there's just no private rooms. So just wanted to let you know that. But I'm grateful that we actually have a place to do the retreat. And we'll be opening up registration a little sooner because Peniel Ridge needs their a guarantee from us of 16 students, and so we're going to have registration sooner. We're going to have the early bird discount be due instead of 30 days out, 45 days out, because that's when we have to commit to them, and so we would have a financial obligation at that point. So anyway, so that'll, I wanted to give you all that update, and I also want to give you the update about the space. I think most of you know now that we are going to be able to stay here, and that's great. We're really grateful, and most of what we're looking at, from what I understand, is going to be intact. So aesthetically, we'll still have the screens, and we'll still have a few things are going to change. A few items, Mary, the studio, the lady that had the studio here, will take a few of her items, but mostly we'll be able to keep this. And they have asked us to move our meditation to Tuesdays starting in September. So the 1st of September, we're moving to Tuesday night. So I hope that will still work for everybody. But that's just, it's going to work out better on Tuesday. So we're going to move that to Tuesday. So I'm just grateful that we're going to be able to stay here. And next day-long retreat is August 26th. And that's going to be the Open Awareness Mind Like Sky day-long. And I'm also doing a four-night retreat in North Georgia Mountains in early October, and registration for that will open this week. So I'll put that in the email newsletter if anybody wants to participate in that retreat. They're just now opening registration for that. So it's about 4.5 hours from here, really beautiful, really nice place to do a retreat. So if anybody's interested in that one, that will open up. And I've still, registration and booking is still open for the Buddhist Tour of India. If anybody's interested in joining me for that, there's information on the table. And your support is what allows us to continue to operate, and so your donations are what allow us to have this beautiful space and to pay rent. So we appreciate your support. And there's a donation basket on the table, and there's also a credit card processor if you want to charge. And the time that I offer here is also on a donation basis, in that I don't get a fee for my time. So if you want to support my teaching, there's also a envelope for teacher donations. And if you'd like to be added to our email list, we have a sign-up sheet on the table. And if everybody would clean up, the round cushions go here, the square here, and the chairs go against the wall.